Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Is there any way we could listen to a violin?
To play a violin?
Yeah.
I'm not going to play a violin for you, but...
That's violin maker Brian Skarstad you're hearing. The idea for today's episode came to me when I was sitting in a concert hall in New York City listening to a well-known string quartet, the Kronos Quartet, if you're curious. In case you're wondering, this isn't something I do every day. I'm more often to be found with one child perched on my head while I'm yelling at the other one. I exaggerate slightly, just slightly. Those of you with children, though, can appreciate what it's like to suddenly find yourself still, uninterrupted, able to take things in. It was in this blissful state that I started to focus on the instruments and to think about the wood that was vibrating and making the lovely sounds that were resonating through my body. Wood. Having not that long ago studied botany, I started to think about the fact that this music was yet another gift of the trees. And I wondered, just how big of a role does wood play in the experience I'm having? And then it occurred to me that I happened to know a world-class violin maker, so I thought, why not talk to him? Little did I know that it would be like opening a portal to a secret world. The following is taken from two interviews with violin maker Brian Skarstad. We recorded them in his studio in Pleasantville, New York. If you notice differences in sound quality, that's because I've upgraded my mic, so the recent interview sounds better. Here we are looking at the first complete violin made by his son, Will Skarstad, who is following in his father's footsteps.
This is the violin that my son made this violin. This is the violin that we have just produced. It just strung it up last week.
Wow, it's beautiful.
There's so much to like about this violin, at least I think so.
Tell me about the wood that it's made from.
This actually is American wood. This is a piece of Vermont maple.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was his first violin, I thought, well, if he messes it up, let's just mess up a piece of Vermont maple and not a piece of Bosnian maple.
You can see the grain so clearly.
Yeah, right now, his next violin is, we bought a piece of wood, even though I have a lot of wood, we just bought a piece of wood from Slovakia.
Wow.
That he'll be.
So this looks very different than the back. So this is a different piece of wood.
This is the spruce.
That's the spruce, right?
It's a long line, just like the top of the guitar is generally spruce.
Right. Can I touch it?
Yes, you can. Yeah. Mm. And you sort of feel it's. I mean, this is oil varnish. This isn't the kind of varnish that you go to the hardware store and paint on. This kind of varnish, you rub it on with your hands.
Mm.
Just several coats, just rubbing it on with your hands.
Yeah.
So, and that's why we still like texture in the top. It's not smooth.
Yeah.
We like it to feel a little bit organic.
Skarstad makes all of his violins by hand, including such painstaking elements as the purfling, the ornamental inlay at the edge of the violin, made by cutting a narrow trench and embedding incredibly thin strips of wood. It's this handmade aspect, central to the craft of violin making for centuries now, that first drew Skarstad's attention as a kid.
I started the violin, I guess, when I was in the sixth grade. I grew up in Utah. You know, I was never a great violinist, but I always was good enough. And so, you know, and I played in all the good youth orchestras and all states and things like that. But when I was when I was 12, I guess I must have been 12 years old, soon after I started, my dad took me to a local music shop. And we went in and we were probably buying strings or rosin or something like that. And I saw there a carved white scroll. Neck and scroll, just the scroll. And this was the 60s, and I said, you know, isn't that amazing? You know, I thought to myself, this is amazing what machines can do. And this guy said, well, that's a hand-carved scroll. I was just shocked. I was shocked that somebody could, I said, it's carved by by with tools, hand tools. I said, yeah, it's all hand carved. And that was the moment I thought, I want to do that.
Skarstad marvels that he has managed to make a living making violins.
I told my wife, let's just see how long it can go. You know, if we just can't make it anymore, then I'll go to law school and get a real job.
But listening to him describe the training and the work, you really get the sense of someone with a vocation, something that is all too rare nowadays.
When I was in the violin making school, I would make instruments at home. I'd go to the violin school. I think the school started at 8:30, and I would work till 3 in the violin school. And then from 3 o'clock till 6:30 or 7, I worked in the adjacent business where I was the bow man. I worked on doing all bow restorations for the head of the school. This was the commercial shop. Then I would go home and make violins all the rest of the night.
Wow.
Work on things, and then wake up the next morning and do it all over again, start making violins, you know, in the violin school. And so it was a long, I mean, it was really fun. Everybody at the school was living and breathing violin making. It was really just wonderful.
Violins are made of organic ingredients, that is, things that were once living. Wood from trees, glue made from animal hides. In the old days, the strings were made of sheep intestines, and the bows are still strung with horsehair. In fact, I emailed Brian to confirm that he still uses horsehair, and he wrote back that he only uses expensive stallion hair. Of course he does. I should have seen that one coming, shouldn't I? But let's get to the basics. I asked him to show me the main parts of a violin.
These are all ones that you've made in the case here?
Actually, no. Everything I've made, I've sold.
Oh, wow.
So here's a good one.
So this is, this is not one you've made?
This is not one I made.
Okay.
No.
All right. And this is one that you're repairing, or?
This is one I'm selling. Actually, yeah, this is one I'm selling, made by a friend of mine in 2001. It's a really great violin.
Mm.
It's a really nice violin.
So, okay, do you mind if we just go through the different parts and what they're made of?
Sure.
Okay, so the back. Let's start with the back.
Well, in on this violin and on most violins, the back is maple.
Maple, that's what I thought. Okay.
And the sides are maple.
Mm-hmm.
What's called the ribs. And the neck and scroll is also maple.
Okay. And then the top? What do you call the top again?
Top is the, it's a top. We call
it's
it
the top. That's too easy.
Yeah, I know. Amateurs call it the belly. If somebody calls
really?
It the belly, then you know that they're just sad human beings. But it's spruce.
Spruce, that's what I
thought.
And
there are...
And spruce is a softer wood?
Spruce is a very soft wood.
So it's more resonant, right?
Yeah, you sort of think of a violin. I mean, it's very thin. So it's a piece of spruce that's arched, and it's about... You know, give or take, it's about 3 millimeters thick, the spruce.
And is it the sound post that holds it up at that arch?
Well, there are two things that keep it from caving in, from collapsing. If it was just a piece of 3 millimeter thick spruce, you would string it up and it would just collapse.
Okay.
So two things. On one side of the bridge is a post that fits by pressure and holds up the treble side of the instrument, and on the other side is a beam that is a bar that gets fit and glued in. It's called the bass bar, and that adds strength to the bass side of the instrument.
So I didn't even realize there was a treble side and a bass side. Shows
well, this
you how
is
much
the treble.
I know.
The higher strings.
Right. Of course, that makes sense. Right.
And
yeah.
then the lower strings. So sometimes there are people who are left-handed. They want left-handed violins, so you would put the bass bar on the other side and then put the sound post on the other side.
Makes sense, yeah.
As you can tell, I'm not a musician myself. I felt, grossly exaggerating my knowledge, no doubt, that I had more expertise when it came to the wood itself. At any rate, in my desire to thread culture and nature together, I kept coming back to the wood. You only have to learn a little bit about trees to realize how amazing they are. For instance, only about 1% of the cells in mature trees are living cells. The vascular cambium, a ring of living cells at the perimeter of tree trunks, produces outwardly the food-conducting phloem cells and inwardly the xylem, through which rise water and minerals. The cell walls of the xylem eventually thicken like miniature medieval fortresses and kill the living cells within them. That's how we get wood. But dead and living parts exist in symbiosis in a tree. Most trees, like some kind of superhero, can sprout back to life when cut down. William Bryant Logan, in his book Sproutlands, talks about a grove of trees in Australia, for example, that is genetically identical to the fossil plants known to be more than 40 millennia old. That means the tree is essentially 40,000 years old. Recently, there's been much discussion of the ways in which trees communicate with each other, using chemical signals. I'll refer you to Peter Voleben's The Hidden Life of Trees. But here's the thing. Is it that far-fetched to think that music is one of the ways in which they communicate with us? My husband, who has become an expert on stereo equipment, talks about how a stereo sounds like what it's placed on. His turntable lives on top of a big slab of maple. Maple, he says, gives the music the most pleasing tonality. Of course, he doesn't need to tell a violin maker that. For violin makers, wood is key. They call the kind they use to make their instruments tone wood.
And what are the qualities that you're listening for?
You know, for me, you want to hear kind of a musicality to the wood. Here are a couple of pieces of wood.
Yes.
These are spruce tops and that cut for the violin, for tone wood. But
okay.
That you can, so I'm going to tap one piece of wood with another piece of wood. So I'm going to get it. Now this is a very old piece of wood. This is probably 40 years old or 50 years old. But you take that, and or you take a piece of wood like this. This is another piece.
It's so dramatically different.
It's different.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a difference in size, but you know, there a lot of wood that's not cut for violins won't make that sound. So. You know, I use wood that isn't kiln dried. You never kiln dry wood. It's all
you just air dry it.
Yeah, and it's all very old. My wood is dated, so I bought wood all the way through my career. If I sell a violin, one thing I'll always do is channel more money into buying a stock of wood. And if you know, if there are sometimes you know among the violin makers in this country, you know the word will get out that so-and-so has some really nice wood, and so we'll, especially now where we can send pictures of the wood over the internet, the email, so we buy good wood. Sometimes I'll buy domestic wood from trees that, you know, we'll hear that. I remember somebody cut a tree up in Vermont that was just spectacular violin wood, just spectacular, and this was a tone wood cutter, and he was getting... You know, I don't know what he got, maybe 40 or 50 backs, violin backs out of this tree. And there was just a scramble all over the country for people who would buy them. The truth is, I mean, wood matters. And the wood I buy today is probably not wood I will end up using. My son will probably use it because we like wood that's
old. Is that him working that we're hearing?
No, I think that's a
that's
electrician.
Okay.
Right. No, we don't use machines.
No, that's true. That's
so,
a machine. I heard some.
Yeah.
So, what was I going to say? So, how old on average is the wood that you use?
I use wood that's probably these days at least 20 years old. And I have wood that's 75 years old. You have to be careful with that because wood starts to take on different characteristics as it dries. So, I mean, it's funny, I work on lots of very old violins, 200 or 300 year old violins, and that wood works differently than fresh, even 100 year old wood. It can be almost ceramic in hardness. It doesn't cut in the same way. You need to use tools in a different way when you're putting a patch into an old violin like that.
So the aging process obviously continues after the violin is built.
It does.
And it does. So in what you're saying is, in a sense, like you want a certain age built in when you're building the violin, and right. then, but
we
don't want the wood to be too old, and then you
want
it to
some stability. Plus, every piece of wood has tensions that grow into the wood as the tree grows.
Right.
There are different tensions into the wood. So as you cut the violin shape out, and you start cutting, carving the arch of the violin, all that's done by hand. You know, it gradually is relaxing some of those tensions in the wood.
Mm.
So I always think that the older the wood, the more those tensions have already kind of, you know, reached. The wood has become more stable.
Done what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a brand new piece of wood, you know, all bets are off. Sometimes you see commercial instruments that are made with brand new pieces of wood or even 2-year-old pieces of wood. And they end up cracking and bending and moving in ways that make the violin really, really difficult to maintain.
This theme came up again when we were looking at Will's violin.
So you're really working with time in a way. I mean, because you have to think, first of all, of the history of the wood and the materials that you're working with.
Right.
And then you have to sort of project forward to what
right.
how it's going to alter over time and how it's going to come into its own.
That's right. That's right. My teacher said, if you string up a violin on day one and it sounds just great, he said, you have a problem.
Hmm.
You have a problem.
Well, it's so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on what day do you know if it's okay?
Don't really know. I mean, we think it sounds good now, and we're going to, you know, it's always the great unknown. We don't know.
Yeah.
One theme that came up over and over is the way that each minute detail can affect the way a violin sounds. I asked Brian to give me some examples.
Things like, well, I always remember when I first got out of violin making school, I made a long string of violas. I played the viola growing up, and I thought there was a good market for violas. So I started making violas, and with every viola I made, that it got sort of more and thicker, more and more bulbous. The arch got bigger and the ribs got bigger. I was thinking that the more resonating airspace in that viola, the better it would sound. And that wasn't happening.
Mm.
You know, I was sort of, they weren't sounding better, they were sounding worse. And so I was visited in my shop at that point by a guy who was a pretty well-known viola maker, very nice guy, who sat and was looking at what I was doing, and he said, you know, he said, and I had just gotten out of violin school, so and I was really interested. He said, it's counterintuitive, but if you lower the arch of your instruments, they'll get more powerful.
Mm.
If you flatten the arch, they get more powerful. And that lesson has stuck with me all the way through. At that point, it was like another bell went off, and I thought,
right.
Well, okay. And I started making flatter and flatter arches, like some of the great old makers. Guadagnini was a famous maker who made this in his best periods, making very flat arches. Stradivari, in his best periods, had to sort of flattish arches,
mm-hmm.
not big, voluptuous arches, but sort of mm-hmm. flat. And sure enough, they got better. So things like that can make a difference. Varnish makes a huge difference. We're always messing around with varnish. When I was in the violin school, I was making varnish in the backyard. And
how do you do that?
It's tricky. You have to, you bubble up air through turpentine and linseed oil, and you cook it, and it has a certain tendency to want to explode, that, you know, if you get it wrong. So I haven't made varnish in a long time. There are instead people who have the right facilities who are really going back in the old world of 18th century varnishes, just to see what those guys were doing. How did they do it? It couldn't have been that difficult.
I mean, they had only various turpentines, and they had various, I mean, they had all kinds of things, you know, egg tempuras. Mm. They had, you know, there were all kinds of really, really organic materials. And those varnishes are known to us. But which ones did the, when these guys, when Stradivari made a violin, he didn't make his own varnish, he went down to the corner shop and bought some varnish from a guy, a bottle of varnish, from the same guy who was selling to the guys who were varnishing tables.
That's Antonio Stradivari he's talking about, the Italian maker of stringed instruments from the 17th century, whose violins, which have been prized since at least the 19th century, can fetch into the tens of millions of dollars today.
So how does, could you give me an example of how varnish affects sound?
Yeah, if quality? You, it's like, I mean, you think about it like a parka. If you put too much varnish on, if it's too soft, it's like just taking the instrument and just covering it with a coat.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And it's just going to stop the sound of
the booth. Right,
muffle it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have to be careful with that. I if you look at, and we do, the really old instruments, there's not a lot of varnish on those instruments. There's a lot of the, and granted, a lot of that varnish has been rubbed off over the centuries. But, I mean, there are some examples of pristine instruments. There is a Stradivari that is brand new, that's in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford.
Brand new.
It's a brand new instrument.
It's, you mean, meaning it hasn't been played?
It hadn't been played. It's in mint condition.
Where was it all this time?
It was, you know, I'm not sure the history of it. This is called the Messiah Strad. It was back in the days in the 1800s, early 1800s, when they were sort of realizing that Stradivarius, who worked until 1740-something, that his instruments were among the best or the most prized back in those days. They were being collected largely in France, although to some extent in Italy. And here was this violin that came out of somebody's cabinet that was in mint condition. And it has stayed in mint condition. So those are really interesting violins for us to look at.
I imagine you learn things from them.
I went to Oxford early on, just to the Ashmolean Museum, just to see that violin. Mm. Just to see that violin. And
that surprised you about?
Well, yeah. I mean, number one, it's not perfect. Mm. So, I mean, the violins we make are much more precise, because in those days, he was trying to buy Nikes for his kids. You know, he was pushing it ahead. He had stuff to do. So, but by the same token, the things that he did with that violin, the violin is a lesson that has many lessons for violin makers who really look. Many lessons. How the varnish was applied and how the scroll was cut, how the edges were done. I mean, I have pictures when we're arching instruments, I go back to those pictures of the Messiah Strad just to, you know, get a lesson from, you know, one of the great makers.
Stradivari may fetch a pretty price, but in fact all violins are unique. And this is because there are so many variables at every step of the process. Think about it. The body of the wood, the body of the violin maker, the body of the violinist all go into the dynamic that ultimately produces the music we hear.
Everyone is different. Everyone is different. It's like human beings. Everyone is different. I like some and I don't like some. It's just like human beings, right?
Right. It gets personal.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
It gets personal. What do we mean when we say that? I suppose, among other things, we mean this sense of the individual, the particular. When Skarstad encounters a new violin, it's an encounter with a particular instrument, but also, in a sense, with the person who made the violin.
It sounds like you relate to the violin almost like a person or something that's alive.
Well, I think that's, I mean, I am not kind of a crazy person, mystical person that way, but I think that's right.
And well, sometimes it's hard to find the right words.
But I can almost, I can tell, you look at some of these old instruments. I had a violin here last week that was made in 1841 and made in this country, made in New York, by somebody I'd never heard of. And it was just a funky violin in so many ways. Strange wood, strange outline, strange inlays. Everything was odd about this violin. But I can't remember a violin that I've liked more than this. And I'd never heard of this guy, and I went to the books to see if I could find something out about him. But he obviously lived in the mid-19th century. There's nothing I wouldn't know anything about it. And yet, there was something about that violin that sort of connected me with that guy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that he... And I would hope that in the future, people 100 years from now see one of my violins, you know, come to their shop, and they'll see the same thing. They'll mm-hmm. say, well, look what he did. He did a good job.
You're touching something that they have created with their hands, so there's an right. oddly intimate connection there. Right. I mean, I think about, you know, I'm a big reader, so I think about connections to books that I've read, but it's not the same, right? Like, because there it's more, I mean, it is personal, but in a different way, right? But the idea of having that connection to something that physically they have handled is curiously intimate.
Violins are not like model airplanes. You know, they're almost like a book. There are mm-hmm. everything. There are many, many, many aspects that we concentrate on mm-hmm. that all work together. And when they don't work together very well, what that tells me is that the guy who did this, like this violin last week, he didn't make very many violins. I mean, he didn't really learn from a skilled violin maker. So I maybe this was his only violin. But he clearly knew how to work with wood. And that story was mm-hmm. really interesting to me. It was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. What he did, how he put it together.
In spite of Skarstad's shrugging off of the mystical dimensions of this conversation, as he put it, he's Norwegian, I found his description of what happens when somebody hands him a violin particularly moving.
When somebody hands me a violin, as happens every day, many times a day, people hand me their violins, these precious things that have become extensions of their body. I have to say that I always think that those violins are glad to be in my hands. Not exactly glad, but that they're... I get it. Mm-hmm. I get this. I know I can just hold it and know what's happening. If there's a problem, I mean, I sort of feel like... If I can't get it right off, can't figure out the problem with sound right off, I will find it and improve it. But I've always said I could almost hear the violin exhaling and mm-hmm. you know, and relaxing. Here it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I can, you know, it's all right. It's mm-hmm. okay here.
Nice, isn't it? And in fact, Skarstad has had some rather interesting instruments in his hands during his career.
Well, I'll just say one of the stories that I have not seen the movie The Red Violin. I don't mm-hmm. know that. I never saw it. You think I would have? I should have.
I saw it a long time ago in Paris.
Right. But I will tell you that the day that was the Mendelssohn Strad. It's known as mm-hmm. It was known as the Red Violin. But when that got sold in the movie at auction at Christie's for a record price at that time, over $1 million. The guy, it was bought by a wealthy American family, and the guy who did the bidding at Christie's secured it, he grabbed it, he ran outside of Christie's in London, I don't know if you know Christie's in London, mm-hmm. it's a really interesting area, and got to Heathrow, climbed on an airplane, flew here, got into his car, and drove right to my workshop.
Really?
Right here.
Wow.
And together we went over that violin and adjusted it and cleaned it up and made it in a way that it would have the maximum sound.
Did it require a lot of work?
No, it didn't. It was actually in pretty good shape. But after, you know, when violins are in auctions, thousands of people hold them. So things happen and, you know, bridges go out of alignment and yeah. strings go out of alignment. And at that point, it was just a, you know, an expensive Stradivari. And I mm-hmm. see them pretty routinely. But it wasn't the Red Violin. It wasn't the famous Red Violin at that point. But so when people say to me, have you seen the Red Violin? I say, well, actually, Yes, I have seen the Red Violin, but I haven't seen the movie, but I know the Red Violin.
That's a great story. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Check out the show notes at in-the-weeds.net, where I've posted some pictures and interesting links. And hey, if you like this podcast and all that it promises for the future, be so kind as to leave me a positive review on iTunes or wherever you listen. The next episode will continue this week's theme. I'll be talking to violist Judy Nelson from the New York Philharmonic.
People always ask me, what's the secret of Stradivari? Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, the secret of Stradivari is they don't all sound good. That's the secret.